This is the In Self-Defense Podcast with Don West and Sean Vincent, exploring high-profile self-defense cases and identifying the lessons learned for concealed carriers.
Hey everybody, thanks for listening in. This is Sean Vincent. For those of you who listen to this podcast or have for some time know that Don West and I use this time to talk about the legal risks associated with self-defense. We look at high-profile cases and we dissect them, talk about the lessons learned for concealed carriers, and we do that from a legal point of view. Don West is National Trial Counsel for CCW Safe. He's a veteran criminal defense attorney, a career criminal defense attorney. It's the only kind of lawyer he's ever been, and he's been that kind of lawyer for approaching 40 years now. I'm a litigation consultant, which is a way of saying I'm not a lawyer, but I have had the honor of working with a lot of really amazing lawyers, including Don, on multiple self-defense cases. And for CCW Safe, I spent a lot of time looking at high-profile self-defense cases and writing articles about them that you may have read on the CCWSafe.com website. Don and I look at things from a legal point of view. But today we're going to be joined by Steve Moses. Steve Moses is a really impressive guy. He is, amongst many other things, a defensive weapons instructor. He's been doing that for more than two decades, approaching 30 years, I think. He's a licensed personal security officer. He is, at this time, a reserve deputy officer. He's served on special task force for as a special response team for multi-precinct law enforcement. He's a jiu-jitsu student and instructor. And in fact, you know, that's one of the things that I find most impressive about Steve Moses, is that even though he's been doing this for a very long time and he's got so much experience and knowledge to his credit, he's never stopped being a student. He's attended over 100 self-defense classes, and he incorporates everything he learns into what he teaches, and his insights super valuable. I'm glad in the coming months we're going to have more of Steve Moses on this podcast so that we can look at things not just from a legal liability point of view, but also from a tactical point of view. Today, what kicks off this collaboration that Don and I are going to have with Steve Moses is that we're going to look at what the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, has changed about how concealed carriers should handle themselves and what they should visualize when imagining self-defense scenarios that they might encounter. Don West is going to remind us that even though the circumstances have changed, the laws have not changed. And Steve, as a weapons instructor, is going to give us some advice on how to change our mindset, how to adapt our mindset to a COVID-19 world.
Well, just want to say hi. How's things where you are?
Actually, things are pretty calm out here. We're seeing a little bit of the strain on businesses and grocery stores, but for the most part, it's pretty close to business as usual.
And out here is in the heart of Texas, I imagine, right, Steve?
Very much so. I'm located about 70 miles southwest of Fort Worth, and so very small town. The town I'm actually residing in probably has about under 300 residents, and so it's pretty low-key here.
Well, for an introvert, that's a dream, isn't it?
I'm enjoying myself. It's not a real radical change.
Nice. You know, for the listeners, we were offline, the three of us, talking about whether we are extroverts or introverts, and Steve, you said you're an introvert. Don, you're a famous introvert. I'm a pretty famous extrovert, and that comes into play while we're surviving quarantine in this COVID age. I've been through corporate training in the past where they do personality tests and they determine if you're an introvert, then you get your energy, you recharge your battery, so to speak, from being alone. And if you're an extrovert, you charge your batteries being out in the world. So Don, how's that been for you?
Well, it's been great so far, actually. My biggest concern right now is that it won't last long enough. I'm kidding.
Right. Pandemic aside, if there was an excuse to stay inside, you'd be good. Yeah. Meanwhile, my wife thinks I'm crazy because she's an introvert too. But I'm absolutely craving like a dinner party.
Isn't it funny? Isn't it funny how personalities that we have very little control over as we grow wind up being such a driving force in who we know and how we know them and who we long to talk with. And for many of us, we're just fine to be on our own with a good book or a Netflix subscription.
Yeah, you know, Don, I once lived on a sailboat, right?
And Yes.
I had these visions in my youth of traveling the world on this sailboat, crossing oceans, right? And I'd read all these books about people who have done it, including people who have done it alone. And then I bought this boat, and I spent pretty much 7 days on it, moving it from the west coast of Florida to the east coast of Florida. And I just about went batshit crazy. By day three, I was clinically disturbed. So I abandoned that dream.
That was about enough of the world at sea.
Yeah, that's enough. That's enough. It's a terrible idea, actually, having a boat, is what I came to that conclusion. So now I'm happily boatless and amongst lots of friends most of the time.
Well, Sean, you know that people say the two happiest days of their lives are the day they buy the boat and the day they sail the boat.
The day they sell it, yeah, they get rid of it. There's some truth to that. Now, I do actually have some very specific, keen memories of time on the boat that I enjoyed, but happy those days are over. But that's all just a long way to say that we're recording this now in April 2020. We're in the midst of this pandemic, and we've all been on lockdown, social distancing for a while.
We are receiving some encouraging words through the media, but only encouraging in that maybe we're starting to see the worst of it in certain areas. But of course, that doesn't tell us that the death toll won't continue to rise and perhaps rise dramatically. It's only that some of these social isolation things are actually beginning to have an impact, that people will be conscientious and vigilant about it. It may very well have a significant impact on how far it spreads and how high the spike goes in the curve.
Yeah, and I imagine, and it's different for everyone. Like New York's obviously getting it now. Seattle had it, was the first epicenter, and now we're seeing you guys are out in Texas. And Steve, I saw in the news that out east, they're on I-10, they're in the highways leading in from Louisiana. They're stopping people and trying to find out where they're going to be quarantining while they spend time in Texas.
That is correct. I've seen signage to that effect.
Is this a signage all the way out where you are, even?
Actually, this was not so far here. We just moved a short time. We'd been spending time in East Texas, over in Tyler, Texas.
Okay,
and sure. So we're relatively close there to the Louisiana border. And yes, over in that part of the world, there were signs all over the interstate. And this was on I-20 saying the very same thing, Sean.
So if you spent time in East Texas around Louisiana, you're not a stranger to hurricane preparedness, are you, Steve?
No, I am not. I came from western Oklahoma, so the big concern we had out there, of course, was tornadoes.
Sure.
And so the hurricane thing was something kind of new to me. But while I was there in East Texas, we never experienced that, although we did have some pretty torrential rains. I guess one of the reasons East Texas is so pretty is because of its all the rainfall and its proximity to the coast. But there's a price that goes along with that.
Sure, all that Gulf Coast rain. Don, you and I spend a lot of time in Florida know about that. And Don, you and I both know about hurricane prep. I heard somebody, one of the emergency disaster management folks, kind of described this pandemic as like a series of hurricanes. It's like hurricanes striking different metro areas at different times, and lasting for a long time. Do you ever get that sense while we're in this hunkered down mode?
I'm not sure how to process all of this. This is such an unusual experience for me to see the numbers on TV, to see the red dots scattered around the country that show the concentrations, but not being able to see anything visually. You know, we're not seeing images of tornadoes. We're not seeing the circular motions of the weather reporting that's showing where the heart of the hurricane is. I'm still not able to process this in the same way as I would the kind of natural disaster that we've been talking about. And at the same time, I know that many of the same precautions and frankly, exercising some of the same common sense, getting the right kind of supplies, doing the right kind of preparation without being excessive or too selfish, preparing for the worst, hoping for the best, all of that fits nicely into what we're going through right now.
We just can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, and it's the preparing for the worst, which is what I wanted to talk to you guys about today. You know, Don, you and I talk about self-defense in these podcasts all the time. You're a lawyer. I'm a litigation consultant. You've been practicing criminal defense law for, are we getting close to 40 years now, Don?
It is. It's very close to 40 years.
And I got my start working on a big case with you 8 years ago now. And as a litigation consultant, I get the privilege of working with amazing lawyers all over the country on high-profile, high-stakes cases, and a lot of them have been self-defense cases. And Steve, I've been reading your articles on CCW Safe for a while now, and I've really enjoyed your insight. And there's something that you wrote recently about the, you know, being a concealed carrier, being concerned with self-defense in the COVID pandemic era. And you related back to a time where for some situation or another, you lived in a high crime area. And so you talked about a heightened state of alertness, and that now, you know, right now we're dealing with a pandemic, but we know with this massive unemployment and what's almost certainly going to be a steep economic decline, maybe it's time to start thinking of all areas like high crime areas. That's what you wrote.
That is correct. Preparing for a potential incident doesn't necessarily make you paranoid. My wife and I, we live down in a portion of East Dallas. Our brother-in-law, at the time, he owned a ministry, and basically he was ministering to people that had served prior prison sentences for drug-related offense, which basically came out of the system with nowhere to go. He came up with a really unique ministry, and so my wife was doing some work for him at the time. They owned a three-story building in a high crime area. There was a loft floor. Our economic situation, my prior experience has been in oil and gas where we're going through a decline. It just seemed like it was a good time for us to go ahead and take advantage of something that we could live in relatively inexpensively. We were there for 3 years. During that time, my wife's Kia Sorento was broken into and vandalized 7 times, 1 week twice. And it was a high crime area. There was a lot of violent crime. There was a lot of homeless people, substance abuse, alcoholism, and so that is the area in which we lived and operated. And my background had kind of prepared me for something like that. I had been a defensive firearms trainer for 26 years. I was a reserve deputy constable. I was doing executive protection, and I was either teaching or training or taking classes all the time. And so it was like, oh, okay, well, good. This is an opportunity for me to kind of go down here and kind of see what the real world is like for people in high crime areas. I don't recommend it, but by the same token, the what knowledge I derive from that I consider to be invaluable. And basically, I was at a point where I was simply aware, I was prepared to deal with people, I protected my wife, I protected my valuables, I protected myself, or myself. And after a while, it became kind of the new norm. And I lived down there with other people that had lived in that same area, and I noted that the people that had been there for a long time moved with a certain amount of ease, but by the same token, you could tell they were kind of dialed into their surroundings. And so to that end, this has served me well, and I do not think it would be a terrible idea for people to kind of, you know, take on that same outlook and just for, you know, the time being, really kind of amp up their situational and general awareness, managing unknown contacts. There's really no downside to this. And so to that end, I simply made that recommendation without saying, oh, let's just fall into complete paranoia. We can still have a high quality of life, in my opinion.
Yeah, so something you said there, like you said that the people who were used to living there, they were dialed in. And I think that is, when you say something like situational awareness, that's essentially being dialed in, right?
Yes, sir. What you did not see is you did not see people walking to stores from their car or back from stores to their car, fixated on their you know, looking at their handheld cell phones.
Right.
They weren't on the phone. They weren't texting. Basically, they walked with their heads up. And they looked around, and if they saw a person whose intent was somewhat suspicious, they steered around them. The same was true when people were pumping gas at a gas station. It was really interesting, just kind of, you know, looking at people and noticing how many of them, as they pumped gas, they kept their heads up. You know, they looked around. But by the same token, they didn't seem any kind of any, you know, level of agitation where they were really thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, the boogeyman's going to jump at me. It was just like, okay, this is just something I do. It's an everyday thing. And so I just took note of that at the time, Sean.
So there's a difference between being aware and being paranoid.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and isn't that, Don, you and I have talked to Bob O'Connor before. Bob O'Connor was... we encountered him during the Zimmerman case. He was wasn't he the chief homicide detective for Sanford Police Department?
Well, I think at the time he was the captain there in charge of that investigation. Yes, and he has had a long and distinguished law enforcement career, having worked in many different agencies, including the state agency and for state attorney's offices. So he's one of those guys that's seen it all over a lengthy career.
Yeah, and one of the things that really stuck in my mind about our conversations with him is he has this concept of the warrior mindset, which he feels all concealed carriers should have. And despite what it might sound, the warrior mindset is really all about recognizing potential threats and then doing what you can to avoid those before they become something that could be potentially violent. And your conversation, Steve, of being dialed in and having situational awareness reminds me of that. A lot of that is, like you said, managing contacts. Talk to me a little bit about managing contacts.
Well, what I have learned through some of the training that I have undergone is that a high percentage of people, in order to close distance, so that they can then follow through with a violent assault, if indeed that is their intent, or it could be just something like a robbery, of course, is violent. But in order to get into a position where they can actually follow through with their intent, they have to be relatively close. And most people have what's considered to be kind of a normal, you know, social distance. Now, I know it's kind of has a different, you know, connotation now, but there's distances at which you're comfortable with people that you don't know, and there's distances at which you're comfortable with people that you do know and trust. And so what people will do, and I had this happen to me multiple times by persons that, as far as I know at this time point, were panhandlers, is they want to approach to you within, you know, 3 to 4 feet, and then where they can pressure you to, you know, give them money. Well, the negative thing about that is that bad guys, if you will, they realize they too have to get that close. And so there's basically one of two ways for them to do that successfully. Is one, they're going to have to ambush you. That is, they simply walk up on you, or they're behind concealment so that when you walk by them, they're close enough at that distance. But in more open areas like that, transitional areas like parking lots where people were moving from one place to another place, which was not going to be where they were going to stay, that's where they would confront you. And so by simply, you know, when someone would come up there and start approaching you, just say, hey, man, I can't help you. And in most instances, you can stop people in their tracks, you know, 6 or 7 feet away, and they don't take offense. There have been instances where they continued to encroach. They were a little bit more persistent. And then at that point, then I would simply, you know, change my tone, move around, make sure there wasn't somebody approaching me from the rear, and I'd say, you need to stay back. And typically, they would respond to that. And then there were, you know, there were an instance or two where the person continued to that time, and then at that particular point, then I just dropped my stance. And I don't want to do it here on the phone, but I would issue a very loud stay back, you know, I mean, just from using my diaphragm and project my voice. And that would typically freeze people in their spot, and they would go ahead and, you know, walk off. There's multiple advantages to doing that that I can see, one of which is not only have you manifested your intent to, you know, not comply with, you know, or not let them overpower you, but again to, hey, I will defend myself if necessary, but it also calls attention to your position. And that's one of the things that most people that are, you know, thinking about affecting a street crime do not want to do. So just that little simple thing right there, to the point where now I can do that, you know, without having to give a lot of conscious effort to, you know, how I'm going to accomplish that. And this goes back to training that was provided to me by Craig Douglas, just an outstanding, you know, master defensive tactics and firearms instructor. And there's multiple firearms instructors that are teaching that particular tactic or technique, if you will, at this time.
Well, and it sounds like one part of that is you're communicating that you're not an easy mark. One, that you're aware of them, you're suspicious of them, and you're prepared to respond in a way that maybe socially some other people might be uncomfortable with, and that's the leverage they have on you.
Absolutely. And there is something that goes along with that, that is my not only my mental preparedness, but my, you know, the skill sets that I bring is that I am comfortable that I can deal with this situation, or I should be able to deal with this situation, because of the prior training and the tools I have on my person. And so I think that's important, is that concealed carriers should probably feel like, okay, I can defend myself and I will defend myself. And I believe that actually that kind of sends off a vibe to, you know, people that were, you know, contemplating, you know, performing a crime, senses that's like, okay, I'm looking for a payday. I'm not looking for a fight. I will go someplace else. And so, you know, a lot of times when you just see people just kind of hysterically stay back, and then by their very body language, you know, they're kind of recoiling, they're trying to create distance, right. They're leaning back, their hands are in a position that suggests compliance. that suggests to that same person that, okay, this person is probably not going to be able to put up much of a fight.
But if you have a lot of experience with your firearm, if you've done a lot of training, you've had training, that confidence is going to be detectable.
Yes, sir. You know, I've taken over 100 defensive, you know, weapons and tactics courses. I've been training for, golly, 26 years now. You know, I have, you know, I'm an expert rated, have an IDPA expert rating with my handgun. I'm a, you know, brown belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. This is not something that the average concealed carrier is going to go to the extremes that I have. And I understand that. And I don't think it's necessary. But I do feel like, okay, if this situation escalates, there's options that I have, including the use of less lethal, you know, tools, less lethal tools, excuse me, yeah. That, you know, gives me the confidence I can probably deal with this. And that's why I think it's important for concealed carriers to not only, you know, be able to understand, okay, what the threat might look like, but ways that they might manage the threat, and then again, have the tools and skills that if it actually, you know, turns into a physically violent encounter, that they can effectively defend themselves.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that in a minute, but Don, while we're talking about part of this idea of having a heightened situational awareness or being dialed into what could possibly be increased threats in the COVID-19 era, I want to go to something that you and I were talking about the other day. Remember when I asked you if in law school, did they ever mention the idea of martial law?
Right, of course. And the answer is no.
No, they don't bring it up. And, you know, martial law is pretty rare, and we haven't had it in our country in quite some time. And I don't think we're on the verge of martial law now. But I bring it up because I think what Steve's kind of talking about here is having a little bit of a paradigm shift. You know, people who are, I don't know, survivors, people who adapt to new situations recognize what's changed quickly, but it's also important to recognize what's not changed quickly. And so we may be in a period where soon the economic downturn might increase crime, might turn areas that once felt safe to being unsafe. But what hasn't happened, probably what is not going to happen, is they're not going to declare martial law, which means all the laws that we abide by now still apply, even in a world where we have heightened threats.
Yes, and I think what you're saying is as times are perceived as being more desperate, people will become more desperate, and there may be people that do foolish things or criminal things that, but for this unique circumstance that we're in, wouldn't happen. So we have to look through our world with different filters, or perhaps with a heightened level of vigilance than we otherwise would, anticipating that some things might happen that 6 months ago we would have never considered.
Yeah,
I'm getting at that.
Yeah, I'm getting at that. You know what it makes me think of is, so some years ago when the volcano in Hawaii was erupting and lava was spreading out pretty quickly across the island, and it was blocking off roads and making it a little difficult for people to evacuate, right? And there is some video recorded of a guy who was ostensibly defending his property from what he feared would be looters. But here's this guy coming down this road trying to cut through this guy's property to escape the volcano, and the property owner met him with a drawn pistol. He actually fired the pistol, and this refugee trying to escape the lava was terrified. They ended up pressing charges against this guy who fired his weapon. Considering the world was on fire, and the property owner had felt like the rules had changed. And maybe they had a little bit in normal interactions, but the law hadn't changed, is my point.
Interestingly, the law hadn't changed on trespass either. However, the circumstances had changed that the trespassing, going across the property owner's land to escape the danger of a volcano, would be of a greater necessity. So in some ways, he would have a defense to trespass because of the ensuing lava that he wouldn't otherwise have, just because he may have wanted to take a shortcut. That's probably a good discussion for another day, but the circumstances, you can see how in that instance, the guy trying to get away didn't have any criminal intent. He wasn't a looter. He was a guy trying to preserve his own safety. And the property owner may also have been justified with a heightened concern for people that under those circumstances, we've certainly seen that in almost every incident that national natural tragedy, some event that results in people taking advantage of it, whether it's the low life stuff of looting or the slightly more sophisticated but just as low life stuff of price gouging and selling counterfeit goods to people that desperately need medicine and such. Certainly these kinds of things bring out the worst in people as well as the best in people, and it's so hard when you're confronted to figure out what is what. And I did want to talk with Steve a little bit along those lines. His scenario was, of course, the risk of true criminal activity. And I'm thinking that here we are at a point in time where everybody is at risk from people that they don't would have no reason to otherwise fear. They are at risk from people who don't know that they are a threat because of the transmissibility of the COVID-19 among people that don't have symptoms themselves. And then you compound that with the lack of attention that most people play in their surroundings. So, Steve, I'm curious to know what you think, whether some of these instances may be precipitated by someone just being unaware that they are violating our new rule of social distancing, that people are getting too close and people are reacting to it.
Anyone could be a carrier of the disease, and if I'm someone who is high risk and somebody violates that social distancing, that is potentially a deadly threat to me.
Well, there's certainly the fear of that and a recognized risk. And I think we're starting to see those things in the news already. Most of it appears to be just jerks pranking people or just trying to make YouTube videos, trying to be, I don't know what kind of person does that. I guess someone that's pretty ignorant and has no awareness of the impact on other people. But I've read about half a dozen cases at least where people have acted like they were infected and made some sort of attempt to cough on someone, or about those kids that were coughing and licking produce in a store. And you can open up the...
We heard that story about the bus driver who was complaining about the lady on his bus who was coughing and hacking, and he asked her to get off. She said no, and that bus driver ended up dying from COVID-related symptoms a week later. So it sounds like the question is, if we've identified this as a new threat, Steve, how would you approach addressing that if you were someone who felt threatened or were near high-risk people who seemed at risk from somebody who wasn't obeying the social distancing norms that we've adopted?
Okay, I want to address that, but I also want to insert one more comment before I go there.
Yeah,
and that is that there has been crime spikes already in areas. I mean, long before people were really sustaining any kind of economic duress. And one of the reasons for this is that with so much that's going on, there has been a number of law enforcement agencies that have announced they are not responding to property crimes. They're not responding to theft. They're not responding to assault without injury. Basically, they've kind of triaged what they will respond to. And so what this has done is it has lessened whatever constraints that some of the people that were already conducting criminal activity, this lessened the restraints on them to the point they feel like, okay, I've got a free pass here. The parents are not in the house. I'm going to have a party, and I don't have to worry about being caught. So some of my concerns about criminal activity have to do with people that already are criminals and have been predators for some time that just feel like they have an enhanced opportunity to, you know, go ahead and exploit this situation. Okay, in reference to the statement that you had just made, my take on that is that I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to default to my whole managing unknown context. And that is that I'm going to tell people, obviously, I can't help them. I'll tell them they need to stay back. If they continue to come, I will yell, stay back. And then after that, I'm going to have to do something to preserve that distance, whether that person is someone that perhaps has, you know, they're ill, there's something else that's going on, or they have a criminal intent. And so basically what that's going to involve, guys, is probably going to involve a physical response. There's a couple of different ways to do this. One of the most effective ways, and I'm very, you know, sympathetic to the person that may be looking for help, is just through, you know, simple OC. OC or pepper spray, it works very well on most people. I have been pepper sprayed a couple of times while I was in the police academy, and I will tell you that for me it was incapacitating. Apparently there's a small percentage of people it doesn't have an impact, but the majority of us were incapacitated by that. For the most part, it doesn't have a lethal effect. It's just basically your eyes burn so bad you just can't keep them open. And if you can't see what's going on, it pretty much, you know, limits your ability to accomplish anything physically. So being able to use pepper spray is a way to do that. But still, you know, if I told this person that you need to stay back and they continue to go, I mean, basically, I don't know what their intent is. I don't know what their intent is. And there was a study that was done one time, and they were trying to ascertain some professionals what the average cop killer looked like, and they were unable to come up with a description of that person because people that had actually assaulted or killed police officers varied in ages from the very, very young to the very, very old, from the very, very fit to the very, very weak. And so it's like, I don't know about this person. I don't know whether or not they're a threat. So to that end, excuse me, I would probably go ahead, do everything I can to maintain distance the way I described before, but add pepper spray to my list of tools.
You know, and Steve, I hope in the near future we can do a whole hour podcast on pepper spray and less than lethal force stuff. I've got a whole host of cases that Don and I have looked at from a legal liability standpoint that I'd love to get a tactical look at from you on that. But I mean, to your point, the longer I've been studying these self-defense cases and the more I've been writing about them and the more I've talked to them about Don, the more convinced I am that something like pepper spray or some less than lethal force should be part of the self-defense toolbox. Because Don, most of the like real close calls that we've looked at legally have been cases where it turned out the perceived attacker was unarmed, even though the defender can't always know that, and they're the attacker's being aggressive, or they're on their property or banging on their door. They're in these very difficult, scary situations. But you've said this before, like when you go to a firearm, you're going 0 to 60 in a split second, right?
Yes. Yes, and I think that's right. The cases we see that are quick to be prosecuted turn out to be those scenarios where an armed person uses that firearm against an unarmed person. And of course, then with the ability of Monday morning quarterbacking and witness statements that may or may not be accurate, with statements made about the scene, maybe surveillance tape, you get all of that stuff together, and pretty soon it looks like, in the cliche, a guy brought a gun to a fist fight, or that the threat wasn't imminent, or the attacker wasn't capable of inflicting serious bodily harm or death, or in other words, the gun just came out too quickly. Now, at the same time, the law clearly provides that if someone is threatened and that threat is about to be carried out, and that threat is likely to result in serious bodily harm or death, it matters not legally whether the person is armed. But those cases where the defender gets in trouble is the gun comes out too quick, or it's clearly disproportional to the amount of force that's being threatened. And I think a lot of that has to do either with the lack of training and understanding sort of the use of force continuum, unreasonable fear under the circumstances, or thinking that it's okay to display a gun, or sometimes even to fire a gun to win an argument.
Well, and let's talk about that, Don, because I think you've already encountered a situation where somebody responding to a perceived COVID infraction has brandished a weapon.
Yeah, I want to get Steve in on this too, because the scenarios that we've talked about so far where you see someone that's approaching you, they don't respond to a verbal command, they're continuing to close the distance, it makes good sense to go to the pepper spray and to begin to be proactive in some self-defense techniques. But we're at this point in time where I think others may see themselves as the protector of the general public. And we've already seen some situations, both hypothetical and real, where an individual is perceived as a threat simply because they haven't taken the recommended precautions. They aren't keeping their distance, or they aren't wearing a face mask or gloves, and yet they find themselves, because of their occupation or because of some other need, being in an area that has a lot of particularly vulnerable people. And a hypothetical example might be a repairman goes to fix something that's necessary at a senior center or at a rehab facility, and they're working the same kind of job that they've held for 20 years, but now they're in among people that are particularly vulnerable, and they aren't wearing a mask, or they aren't wearing gloves, or they aren't taking the special precautions to keep the surfaces clean. And they may very well truly know that they don't have the virus themselves. They may have just had a test, or on the other hand, they may have it and not know it. Any of those things, but that wouldn't be known to those that are observing. And whether it's seeing people contaminating food in the store, or a repairman who's not taking what is suggested as the proper precautions to protect others around, I think it's going to get more confrontational. I think people are going to become physical. And Steve, in the situation where someone sees someone that's clearly violating the new social norm feels compelled to confront them about that, you certainly expect there's going to be a response. If the response is, sorry, you know, I didn't think about it, sure, I'll put on a mask or I'll leave or I'll wipe everything down, that's a normal socially responsible response. But what about the guy says, you know, kiss off, buddy, I'm not sick. Oh, I'm just doing my job, leave me alone. And then it goes from there.
Yeah, I tell you what, that's a tough call. One thing I was going to just insert real quick is that actually more people are killed every year, if my understanding of these numbers are correct, with hands and feet than they are with edged weapons and guns. And so in a lot of instances where people have actually defended themselves with a handgun against an unarmed individual, some of those were probably very much legitimate. In a lot of those instances, I think that there's a chance that it could have been handled with less lethal initially, but most people basically there's just they don't have any options between a voice command and then pulling a gun, and mm-hmm. so like, oh, I don't want to get killed by this guy, and out comes the gun. So I'm somewhat sympathetic to that because, yeah, that person very well who is unarmed could be a threat, but I, by the same token, concealed carriers have options, and those options would be definitely to have something on their person very much like OC. In reference to the other thing, Don, of course, this is just going to be my opinion, is that I just kind of have to look at what my role here is. And is my role here as I'm just a concerned citizen that wants to go home at night and protect myself and my family? Or am I actually charged with doing something here that is for the benefit of other people, which, like, that's my store and this guy is spitting on the oranges? Or I am in charge of this facility and this guy comes in and that he is, you know what, obviously just disregarding any safety or health precautions versus, you know, not spreading the COVID virus. And so to that end, okay, those are two different roles. If I'm in a store and I am there and someone starts moving in on me, I'm like, hey, man, can you give me a little bit of space here? And if that person says, nope, the heck with you, then, like, guys, I want to disengage. You know, that is not my time to have a confrontation with someone, because I guarantee if later I end up in a fist fight with that guy or the police get involved and I get arrested or there's video on this or something, I'm going to go, you know, I had the option of simply, you know, leaving, and I chose not to take it.
Right.
And in that regard, I'm like, guys, just take that option. I am a huge believer, and I think you guys have probably seen that by virtue of the articles that I've written, in the right to self-defense. But by the same token, I want that to always be the very, very last option. And what a lot of people don't realize is that typically there were various times prior to the actual physical engagement that they might have done something different that would have prevented that from happening.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of funny you talk about even in a grocery store setting, if a guy's crowding you, that may be on purpose because they're a jerk, or it may be inadvertent because they're distracted thinking about something else. But if you ask for a little distance or you take the distance yourself and they don't respect it, the idea of getting in a fist fight or even within arm's reach of that person defeats the entire purpose of the distancing. There's no better reason than to just go shop in a different aisle, because the very risk that you're trying to avoid would be increased by escalating that confrontation.
I absolutely
crazy
agree.
World. Yeah.
Absolutely agree. But for the most part, you know, that is the police or the sheriff's department, whoever is, the governing authority there. That's who I would call and ask to deal with it. If there were no other options, then I may have to, very well deal with it myself. Mm-hmm. I just want to be able to just clearly articulate why I did that. And, I want to be very careful as to what I say and what I do. And basically, you know, my objective here is I've got to protect these people, or I have no choices but to protect myself. But I've got to protect these people, which may require some sort of physical, you know, action on my part. For the most part, it would be pretty hard for me to go to a gun to someone that was basically just being a jerk. Well, and, you know, coming up to me with that otherwise didn't seem to really have an mm-hmm. intent on, you know, getting physical with me.
Well, you know, keeping in mind, Sean mentioned this early on, the situation has changed that we find ourselves in, but the law hasn't changed particularly on that. The rules of self-defense are the same. There may be other rules that enter into it. In fact, these people that are, whether they're playing pranks or just being jerks, wind up being prosecuted for even a biohazard kind of thing. The people that are purposefully coughing on others or contaminating food. There's terrorism-related stuff. There's also just people that cough on purpose or spit. It can be a form of assault or battery, depending on the jurisdiction. And I'm reading lots of articles about people being arrested for that. Frankly, none of the articles that I've read have been involving someone who's actually infected. They just think that it's their moment of fame on YouTube or Instagram or what have you, and they're pranking. But no one would know that they were infected. No one would know that they weren't truly at risk, which is the whole notion of terrorism, isn't it? It doesn't matter whether the bomb actually explodes. It's the fact of planting one and telling people about it that is the intended effect of fear.
But legally, Don, what you're saying is it's difficult to justify meeting spit with lethal force.
And that would be a temptation. You'd think about that, wouldn't you? That if someone is so crude and insensitive and criminal by intentionally spitting on you in these times where your fear is that you will otherwise be infected and be facing a life-threatening event, why wouldn't you be able to respond with a much greater level of force than you would if it was just somebody mad at you, it spit at you? And I don't think we're there yet legally. I don't think there's any justification for using more force than that from which you are confronted. So I don't think there's any scenario like that that you would be justified using lethal force against someone that is spitting on you. That's a tough one for me, and that's very fact and scenario specific and would involve much more information than we could include in a discussion here. But I think what we're going to see, though, like the repairman that isn't taking necessary precautions in the view of others who is threatened with a firearm, not because there is a true lethal threat involved, but because it's to enforce the point or to win the argument or just to show superior force in a true non-life-threatening situation. We also, when you're talking about contaminated produce or food or that sort of stuff, you're talking about basically defending property. I think there's a really good argument that you're actually defending another person if the goal is for the contaminated fruit to find its way into people that could then infect them, but you really can't use force to defend property in most situations, certainly not lethal force. I think the only exception is Texas, as far as I recall, and the circumstances are pretty limited and pretty rare.
And an apple's a tough sell without the other caveats. So let me, as we're wrapping up here, we've been talking for almost an hour. You know, we're always looking for the lessons for concealed carriers. And Don, you and I, our focus is often on lowering your legal jeopardy when it comes to defending yourself, whether it's with lethal force or any type of force. And what I'm gathering here is when it comes to, you can't right now enforce social distancing with a firearm, with deadly force. That is fraught with legal peril. And Steve, when you talked about how if it were just you personally approached, if you have the opportunity to disengage and leave, that's the best option. Certainly, I think from a legal liability standpoint, walking away from a potential fight all brings your legal risk down, as Andrew Branca says, to zero. Right, Don?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing here is this idea of looking out for a greater good. Like, Don, you're a repairman in the retirement center or senior center scenario. And listening to you, Steve, I think the lesson there is it really does make a difference who's charged with the security and care of those folks. And so if you're not the one charged with that security, then the smart thing to do is certainly the thing that lowers your legal liability is to find the person who is and make them aware of it. And whether that's law enforcement or the manager of a store or somebody who has other resources, they'll be more justified in whatever tactics they deploy to handle that perceived threat than you. And if it is you, then you've got, you know, Don, isn't it, we've seen this before, like in the Michael Drake, a parking lot shooter case. You know, the guy's ostensibly enforcing handicap parking spaces that sparks an argument that ends up leading to him being attacked and then shooting his attacker and being found guilty of manslaughter for it, right?
Yes, that's right. That's the infamous handicap parking spot case in Clearwater, Florida.
Yeah, and the lesson is you can't really use deadly force to enforce parking lot laws, and that's oversimplification of that, but I mean that makes me think of what we've just decided here. Like, when you are a concealed carrier and then you put yourself in the assumed role of an enforcer of anything when you're not otherwise given any authority to do that, you're in essence provoking encounters that have the potential to turn violent. And police officers are trained for this. The average civilian is not. Steve, does that jive with your experience?
They are trained, and you know, they're empowered to do so, and ideally they're more capable of you know, dealing with such a situation than, you know, the average concealed carrier. You know, just the main thing for me is just I always, especially as I get older and I think about protecting what I have, there is no reason for us to get into a confrontation with another person unless we have no choice. And to kind of, you know, maybe jump on or get in on the thing about spitting, you know, if someone spits on me at that particular moment, what can I do? Well, I really can't take revenge for what he did to me if that situation is no longer happening. And, well, then basically I can't respond to that guy. That becomes, you know, a you know, that's a simple assault.
Exactly, Steve. That's an excellent point, because it's over at that point, and you can't respond in anger or revenge. You can only respond in the face of an imminent threat. So I guess if he's getting ready to do it again, you would have the lawful right to defend yourself to whatever extent, you know, you could under that situation. But that's like Sean and I talk about so often, and you talk about it in your training, that's the one shot too many. That's after you've incapacitated the guy, in fact, who intends to seriously injure or kill you. And after they're incapacitated or neutralized, they wind up getting shot again. And that converts a lawful self-defense act to perhaps even murder.
Yes, sir. I mean, okay, another good opportunity to go ahead, get distance, tell that person to stay back, and then it goes right back into that managing unknown contacts, or in this case, you know, managing contact with very questionable intent. If that person continues to encroach upon me, well, then things are changing. And in part, that's going to be also based upon maybe the physical abilities or perceived physical abilities of both the concealed carrier and the person moving in on them. So if I'm a, 75-year-old, 105-pound female, okay, I'm not expected to respond, in the same way that a 30-year-old able-bodied male would be expected to respond. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I'm not saying, oh, my gosh, never go to a gun. I'm like, well, it really depends upon the circumstances. Mm-hmm. But for the majority of us, going to a gun too fast is a big error, and it really can't be taken back.
Yeah, Steve, that sounds like a great final word on this conversation. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to talk about this. And, there's a lot of big question marks left here because we're in a very uncertain time. But I think that goes back to Steve. A lot of the things you say, it's rely on your training and exercise good situational awareness. And use maybe even better judgment than you might otherwise be inclined to use.
Oh, absolutely. And then, Sean, the other thing I might add is that at this particular time when we're isolated, give some thought to visualizing what a confrontation with another person might look like and what your options are. And if you just do something that simple, you basically have a plan in place. It might require some minor tweaking, while the thing is actually, taking place. But just, little things like that, I think that's just a good thing for concealed carriers to do, during this time where maybe we have a little bit of downtime to think about things such as this.
Well, Don, you and I have a bunch of podcasts that do just that, visualize different scenarios for concealed carrier. So maybe we can selfishly plug our podcast by saying now's a good time to go listen to some of our catalog, huh?
I can't underscore enough, though, Steve's last point. I agree. I think this is a good time when people have an opportunity to reflect on their own training, both physical and tactical and legal, to go back and fill in some of the gaps and work on that. Steve has some terrific articles about how to stay sharp while you're at home. Would encourage people to review those, and would like to get you back on again, Steve, and talk about some of those things. I'm especially struck by this notion of just sort of visualizing. I imagine all of us that carry concealed have visualized the kind of criminal scenario that Steve has talked about, but we probably haven't spent much time visualizing sort of the inadvertent contact, the concern about social distancing, people that could be transmitting this disease that don't even know they have it, so that we can be better able at avoiding situations where we have to tell somebody to keep their distance, or that you become overly paranoid just in typical social interaction. So the idea of being aware that that's going to happen if you're in the line at a grocery store, or maybe even to the extent of taking fewer trips, so that you don't wind up in a situation that you didn't want to be in and you feel some sort of need to protect yourself from other people that clearly have no intent to harm you, but just because the rules are different now might inadvertently do so.
That's all great advice, great things to think about. Thank you, guys. And Steve, I can't wait to talk to you again about some more cases.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for asking me to join you.
All right, that's our podcast for today. Thanks for listening through to the end. Before we left, Steve Moses promised that he'd come back and talk to us more about the idea of less than lethal force in self-defense cases, pepper spray. Look forward to that conversation. In the meantime, you guys, be smart, stay safe out there. Take care.